Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Constitutional Matters with myself, Zakira Desai, for the sixth episode of our new show marking the 20th anniversary of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. In our previous episodes, we discussed the history of the Constitution, transformative constitutionalism, the right to education, the limitation of rights, and last week, the right to property. And in this episode of Constitution Matters, we discuss the right to equality. And in studio with me, we have Uzair Adams from ProBono.org, Ellen Boriwondo, legal intern at ProBono.org, Max Taylor and CN Fagan, both candidate attorneys at Bowman's Law. We remind our listeners to join in the conversation by WhatsApping us on 072-238-0712 or SMS us on 47913. To begin the conversation, Section 9.1, which speaks to the right to equality, says everyone is equal before the law and the right to equal protection and to benefit of that law. Max, to begin, can you clarify what the Constitution means by equal protection and benefit of the law?
Sure. So that's a fairly standard liberal right, which are in many constitutions around the world. Basically just saying that every human being is entitled to protection of the law. So whether you're of a different race or gender, the law won't look at those sort of factors when it applies the law. Our constitution is perhaps quite radical in that section 9.2 goes on to say that equality includes the full and equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms, and that goes further than most constitutions in that it speaks to the distinction between having a right on paper versus actually being able to enjoy a right. And so, for example, you might have various rights in the Constitution, but without any access to lawyers or representation, it might not be possible to enjoy those rights. And so our Constitution goes further by providing for the full and equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms.
Now, Cian, we know that Section 34 and Section 38 sort of draws on Section 9 in terms of equality before the law. Do these two sections of the Constitution impose an obligation, both morally and constitutionally, on the state to provide not only the mechanisms, but also the substantial government-run and funded legal aid organizations in order to meet the requirements of Section 9?
So I think that question really depends on how you interpret Section 34. Section 34 says that everyone has the right to have any dispute that can be resolved by the application of law decided in a fair public hearing before a court or, where appropriate, another independent and impartial tribunal or forum. So I think the difference here really turns on whether you interpret that right to mean a right to access the court or a different tribunal or forum, or whether that right actually gives every person a right to the actual means of which to take the matter to court, so the financial means behind it. So what the question you're asking is whether everyone has the right to free legal representation. And in our, according to our constitution and in terms of Section 9 and the right to equality, I would say that there's definitely a constitutional obligation on the state to progressively implement certain government-run and government-funded organizations. Mm-hmm. But I think the key there is that it has to be progressive implementation. At the moment, given resource and capacity limitations, it cannot be said that there is a constitutional obligation on the state to have these institutions available for every person right now. I think what's also important there is the distinction between so for example, a civil or a non-criminal case. So if you notice in Section 35 of the Constitution, every accused person does actually have the right to free legal representation in a criminal law context, but that right is not expressly provided for in Section 34 in terms of the right to access courts in civil litigation.
And Uzair, if I could bring you into the conversation, in terms of unequal access to justice, which section of the South African population would you say is most disadvantaged? And do you think that it has changed since the dawn of democracy?
Zakira, thank you for having us on air tonight. I must say that the section of South African society that is most disadvantaged by this issue will be our poor and our marginalized people. These will be our people who are uneducated, who don't have access to resources, and are often people who live in rural areas where they are unable to access service points that are made available by the government. And so oftentimes these are also people who are unemployed. What is the second part of your question, Zakira?
So do you feel that following the dawn of democracy, do you feel that South Africans, a certain category of South Africans, do not have sufficient access to justice?
Yes and no, Zakira. I can say that there are people, the classes of people that I just described, these are the people who are most disadvantaged, and these are the people who have limited access to justice, so to say. But since the dawn of democracy, I can say that many efforts have been made in terms of trying to make access to justice a lot more accessible to those people. And like my colleague Sian said, it is progressive in nature, and we have made progress.
Ellen, do you share that view that we have made progress as a new democracy in ensuring that all South Africans have access to justice in terms of the judicial system?
Thank you for that, Sakura. I would say there's been progress quite in some areas, but there's still a lack in terms of civil litigation. Because you find that the legal aid is mostly, I would say 90-odd percent litigating criminal matters. So the majority of the section you find which requires civil assistance are still falling through the gaps. And there is quite a number of cases, I think I would say, with what I experienced in Khayelitsha, people coming in and requiring civil assistance, and they would have gone for 5-6 years trying to get the same matter litigated, and without resources and like access points where they can get assistance. So I would say there's still quite a lot that needs to be done, even though there's progress, but a lot still needs to be done.
Max, Ellen has mentioned that there are many people who have fallen through the gaps. Why do you think it is that you have people who, even though they are courts, you do have a number of legal aids, they continue to be sitting in the situation where, even though they have legal aid access, the court system doesn't allow for them to actually see justice, and you find people being extremely just run down, where they don't feel that their matter will ever be heard?
Thanks. Yeah, so I think there are two issues at play here. I mean, before even getting to courts, as Sean mentioned earlier, because there's an emphasis on providing legal representation in the case of criminal matters, in non-criminal matters, your family law, employment law matters, it's often hard for the state to provide free legal representation there because the focus is elsewhere. And I think in those cases, even before getting to court, sometimes it's difficult to get representation to help you even find a settlement or to avoid litigation. The second issue you speak to are issues in the court systems itself. And I think there have been some strides made towards improving justice there. The introduction of district magistrates' courts, the Chief Justice has tried to have some oversight over case management. But I think a lot of this comes down to a difficulty with resources and capacity.
Sian, Uzaid earlier mentioned the fact that there are the poorer community, there is the poorer community who suffers the most. Is it then correct to suggest that the judicial system is only for the elite?
So I think this also goes to the barriers that are inherent in our legal system in its entirety. It's the legal system, or the judicial system, is definitely not there just for the elite. However, there are certain barriers. And obviously, with our history and given that the that indigenous people and the poor vast majority are those that are coming into conflict with the law more often, and the fact that they face the most barriers, in the sense that generally they'll be living in geographical locations that are isolated. They don't have the funds necessary to fund legal representation, and often people will be illiterate and they won't be able to. They don't even know what rights they have for enforcement in our judicial system to start with. I think all of this, coupled with the fact that we don't have the capacity or the legal resources to provide free legal aid to every person that wants to enforce a specific right in our court system, I think that, yes, it does lead one to perceive that our judicial system is aimed at the elite who have money to fund long, protracted and delayed litigation.
Uzair, if you could come into this conversation once again.
Sure.
Just in the last 30 seconds before we take in our break for Maghrib, do you agree with what CN has just said?
I do agree, Zakira, but I must admit that I do feel that something should be done around educating our communities.
I think we could continue this conversation.
Sure.
after the work. I wouldn't want to break your thought. So welcome back to Constitutional Matters after the break. Assalamu alaikum and welcome back to Constitution Matters with myself, Zakira Desai, and joining me in studio is Uzair Adams, Ellen Bariwando, Max Taylor and CN Fagan. In this episode of Constitution Matters, we discuss the right to equality, and we remind our listeners to join in the conversation by WhatsApping us on 072-238-0712 or SMSing us on 47913. Now, before the break, we were discussing whether or not the judicial system is restricted to the elite. CN, I know you had quite a lot to say about this during the break. Would you like to elaborate?
Yes, thank you. I think what's important is just to note that while there might be a perception that our judicial system is reserved for the elite, the state and the three branches of government have definitely gone far in providing for different mechanisms over the past few years that do try and include the majority of the population and the less fortunate. Some examples I'd say would be in a labour law context, the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration. This provides indigent people and anyone really with labour law disputes without charging a fee. It allows them the chance to resolve their disputes in an informal type manner. We also have the small claims court, where you actually aren't allowed to have legal representation, and you basically anything up to a claim of 15,000 rand can be heard in the small claims court without legal representation. And then on the other side, we also have legislation to the effect that it's the Contingency Fees Act, and that now permits an agreement to be made between a legal practitioner and a client where you only charge fees in the event of a successful litigation. Mm. So they definitely, while there is that perception and while the elite definitely do benefit more so than our poorer population from the judicial system, as they are able to fund their litigation, there are mechanisms in place that do aim to include.
I think the important question is whether or not the citizens are educated about these different mechanisms that they have access to. Max or even Ellen, you know, as a part of probono.org, do you feel that our citizens are educated enough to understand if in event that they need to open a case, that they have these mechanisms available to them despite their socio-economic situation?
Thank you for that. I'd say from experience, there's a lot that still needs to be done in terms of educating the public in terms of where they can go to if they have a dispute, like Sian mentioned, the small claims court. I've had a number of people who walked into the office, they have claims like under 15,000, and he or she would say, I've been sitting with this problem for a number of years now, I don't know where to go, I need to get my money back. And you tell them about the small claims and they are surprised. And it's for someone like someone who is literally in the law, they would know it's basic stuff. And but it's, we assume that people know, but they don't know. So there is, for our part as pro bono, we would have to go and hand out leaflets telling people that this is what you do, if you can come in, if you want to ask, if you want to get assistance. So in some cases, the cases that you need to just, oh, this is where you need to go, it's just a matter of telling them, oh, you need to go to the master's office, or this is where you can get assistance with a specific issue that you have. So in some cases, it's not litigation per se, it's just pointing them in the right direction. So yeah.
We have a WhatsApp in from 8926, and Uzair, I'll direct this at you. I know you're eagerly waiting for this question. The WhatsApp says, do criminals reserve or deserve the right, in actual fact, to have access to the judicial system if they have removed the right from the victim?
Certainly, the Akira, just because there is an allegation, first of all, that an accused person has committed a certain offense, that does not limit them to access to this right, because they themselves are also citizens of our country. And again, in legal talk, there is something called the presumption of innocence, and someone is proven until guilt. Innocent until proven guilty, sorry. And so every citizen has that right to access legal resources within the judicial system, regardless of whether or not they're accused person, because only until such time that they are actually found guilty are they seen as a criminal, so to say.
Max, would you like to add to the conversation?
Just one addition there. I think that even if someone has been convicted of a crime, another question arises then, and that is that do all their rights at that stage merely fall away? And do we want to live in a sort of eye for an eye society?
Yeah.
And many argue that even if one has been convicted of a crime, it doesn't follow that we should not look at the conditions that people face in prison, or look to rehabilitate people back into society.
Going to the issue of an increase in legal aid services, I pose this question across the board. Is there a need for more legal aid services, or is there a need to redefine or restructure our judicial system?
Zakira, I would say that there's certainly a need for more legal aid services. I previously actually was an attorney at Legal Aid, and I've also worked for the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, so I've kind of had experience on both ends of the stick. In terms of Legal Aid has done amazing work across the country. They have offices all over. They've got satellite offices. But again, the question is whether or not people in rural areas have access to that information or those services. And then on the other side of things, there is government who has been trying to plow back into our communities by making access to justice accessible via service points and having access to justice week and Wills week and that type of thing. But for me personally, it comes down to educating our community members on the rights, on their rights, so that they can understand their rights in terms of the Constitution, so that they can also then understand that in terms of Section 36 of the Constitution, every right also is subject to a limitation. And that no right is limitless, because a lot of the time our people believe that they've got rights, but they don't also understand that to go with that rights, they have responsibilities. So I hope that answers your question.
Max, I see you eagerly waiting to weigh in.
One more time, sorry, I just wanted to add, I think it is encouraging that the Legal Practice Act, which is a piece of legislation which came into force in 2014 and is slowly coming into force in a staggered way, it seems to envisage the minister down the line making regulations for community service as a component of articles when graduates are training to become lawyers. And I know that's something that some student groups have been pushing for a while. It could address, with adequate supervision, it could address the access to justice problem and the under-resourcing at legal aid if you had law graduates coming through to assist. And the Act also makes provision not just for assisting with legal aid, but assisting at the South African Human Rights Commission. You could imagine assistance in the courts and assisting with just legal education initiatives such as this one.
But how then would we, you know, we made mention of our rural areas. We have issues of tribal lines as well and the structures of tribes and the different cultural norms we have in different communities. How would we then, in these areas where you find that culture is still the dominant and the dominant structure, how would we reconcile the two? I think we can pass this question to Ellen because she's thinking quite deeply.
Yeah, can you rephrase it? I'm trying to understand how and think how to... I could better respond to it, but I'm thinking...
Yeah, so instead of superimposing our legal system and what the Constitution says, how would we reconcile the two in terms of bringing together your tribal lines and what the right to equality says under the judicial system?
You got me there. I was thinking back to my customary law class. You find that sometimes what works in the urban city won't work for someone that is far out in Eastern Cape. So I remember this one discussion that we had when the professor said sometimes you'd need to engage with like the community leaders, you'd need to engage with people who have like some sort of weight in the community and have them spearhead campaigns in ensuring that the law is applicable to even those areas far out, because you might think that we're going into assist, but at the same time you're offending them. So you need to be sensitive to their cultures and their practices, and when you come in and you want to educate them, because they'll think, okay, now you're being superior, you're being educated on us and all of that. So the context matters and how you approach different issues and different matters, depending where you're situated and where they're situated, that really comes into play.
And do you feel that the judicial system has been structured in such a way that it can be inclusive of tribal lines and the structures of different tribes and even religions for that matter?
I would say no. That's just my view, because I would refer to something that I was researching on last year, Muslim marriages. It's a deviation to, but it's not access to justice in any case, because Muslim marriages are at this point not recognized in South Africa. So there's hardships, there's a lot of things that flow from non-recognition of Muslim marriages. So you find that even with the customary law aspect of justice, there's what works for a certain tribe, and there's been adjudication, and it works for another tribe, but it's not been implemented to work for a certain tribe. So there is still that balance that needs to be struck to accommodate all areas of our society.
Sin, would you like to weigh in?
So just going back to, whether our judicial system accommodates different cultures and all of that. I think that on paper or on the face of it, no, it doesn't. I would have to agree there. However, if you look at the substance of some of our court decisions over the years, so maybe procedurally, there's some difficulty in that regard. Different cultures, different tribes living in different communities, rural communities, may not understand or want to subject themselves to the procedures of our very strict and rigid court system. However, our courts have gone a long way, and I mean, just with the Constitution and the Constitutional Court, there definitely is a deeper recognition and understanding of the need to cross those cultural boundaries. I mean, there is case law that is not, I mean, our courts have recognized same-sex marriages, and our courts have recognized rights, the right to equality and the right to equal treatment. So while there's definitely still a far way to go, as you say, Muslim marriages aren't recognized in the same context, I think our courts have gone quite far in the short space of time. I mean, our democracy is still quite young, but they have gone to some extent to really recognize what has been entrenched in our constitution.
You mentioned this idea of rights on paper versus, you know, the rights being actually acted upon in substantive equality. Mm-hmm. Max, within the context of South Africa, has there been a disparity between having equal rights on paper versus actually being able to enjoy our rights?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think there has often been a disjuncture between the promises of the Constitution on paper versus reality. Our constitution is unusually generous in providing, for example, for socioeconomic rights, justiciable socioeconomic rights to access healthcare, education, social security, etc. And in the context of a country with such levels of poverty and inequality, to a certain degree, these rights are more aspirational in character than immediately realizable. And the Constitution, in fact, makes provision for their progressive realization within available resources. Having said that, we shouldn't throw the baby out of the bathwater and forget that these rights have proved a solid basis for litigation, which has led to real change in the lives of people. And you think of the anti-retroviral litigation or access to housing and evictions jurisprudence. There have been real victories for people on the basis of those rights.
You mentioned the victories. Do you think that within South Africa, especially post-apartheid, that a victory is waiting many years before that is realized? Or is a victory actually having the court hear it immediately and not have lengthy legal processes? Because if you see in terms of the land claims that we mentioned over and over, because it's so unique to our constitution that we protect this, is a victory really a victory when communities have waited many years to see their goals realized?
Okay, if I can maybe try and and draw on that, I'd say I think it becomes a matter of empty victories in some situations, because if I can draw on the Krutbum case, the Constitutional Court ruled in a favor, but she ended up dying without having access to the house that she was fighting for. And if you go back to the Silikosi's cases, people are dying without having so it's rights sometimes without remedy, when people actually need for it to actually materialize into something that they can hold. So sometimes it's fair enough to say that there is much that has been done, but the implementation of whatever rulings takes quite longer than you'd expect. So you find that people end up not enjoying whatever the court pronounced on. So there's still challenges.
It's quite
there.
Interesting you mentioned that, because quite recently, and we've mentioned this in our previous shows of Constitution Matters, in Constantia, we found that a number of the land claimants had actually passed away because they've waited so long to see the reality of actually getting back their land. So, Uzair, I know that you have been listening attentively. I think that you deserve your word.
Zakira, in my opinion, I think that there are many legal professionals who would make use of the term a miscarriage of justice. And although we've got certain provisions that enable certain victories, whether or not those victories become realizable at a later stage and people are unable to benefit from it immediately, is questionable. But it comes back to the point that my colleague Max pointed out in saying that it is progressive in nature. And so it's there's a fine line between the two. We can't take away from the fact that it is a victory in essence, but whether or not it's a realizable victory in having people access that victory immediately or soon thereafter is another thing. And so that's where it comes in terms of whether or not that doesn't give rise to a miscarriage of justice. And so, I mean, in our office alone, we've thus far received at least two members of public who have come in and advised that they have been on the waiting list for housing, RDP houses, for in excess of 2 decades. Mm-hmm. Now that, in my opinion, is a miscarriage of justice, and that in itself is a public interest matter, because it's one thing being on a waiting list, but it's another thing having to wait 20 years for you to get that RDP.
So just before the break, I know we mentioned the right of the elite to access the judicial recourse. Do you perhaps agree with many who say that those who were privileged under apartheid continue to be privileged within the judicial system, because when in terms of land claims, for instance, the previously privileged who live on those lands still argue that, you know, they have this claim to the land because they got it, their families got it, have it for generations, so they should not be giving it back.
Zakira, what I can say on privilege is that we cannot take away from what has happened in the past, and we can't ignore what has happened in the past, and we can't ignore that privilege is rife and it has existed. But again, at some point in time, I do believe that our people has to take responsibility themselves, and I think once we reach that point, will we then be able to move forward?
We'll take a quick break and we'll continue this interesting conversation when we return. Welcome back to Constitutional Matters. I'm your host, Dakira Desai, and joining me in studio is Uzair Adams, Ellen Bariwando, Max Taylor, and Sian Fagan. In this episode of Constitution Matters, we discuss the right to equality. Before the break, we had quite an interesting discussion of whether or not the judicial system is only accessible by the elite. And right now, we turn our attention to Max, who is eagerly preparing to answer. During the break, we discussed whether or not government or the state should be responsible for leveling the inequality between the wealthy and the poor. Max, I know that you'd like to weigh in here.
Thanks, Akira. I think absolutely the state has a responsibility. Section 34 of the Constitution, as we've mentioned, says that everyone has the right to have any dispute resolved in a court of law. And the state is part of transforming South African society post-apartheid, and of course it plays a role and has to continue doing so. I think maybe just one thing to mention on that score is that it's not only the state which has a role to play. We've seen that the Constitution gives a lot of scope for civil society and NGOs to litigate and to bring cases to the courts, and corporations should come to the party as well. So I think we shouldn't just sit back and say it's only the state. The state is one of several actors which have a role to play.
We actually have a question that came in from 5138. If you could perhaps take this very quickly. The person is saying that the rule of law today is based on the colonial laws. Now, we know the Constitution was meant to transform what happened in the past and bring it and include everyone in the new democracy. Do you feel that has taken place?
I think that to a certain extent, I understand where the question comes from, but at the same time, I think the Constitution is all-embracing, and it really does try and it does try and achieve this aim of this transformative Constitution, and it really does. Your right to equality, it says everyone is equal before the law. Access your Bill of Rights in general, your access to the courts, everyone has access, has the right to access the courts. Everyone has the right to adequate housing. I don't believe that it's based on colonial legislation, which was very fragmented and not applicable to everyone.
In our last two minutes, we have two questions that we'd like to unpack very quickly. Ellen, do you think that lawyers have a moral obligation in their private capacity to assist in alleviating the inequality of accessing justice?
I'd say that they do, because they have the know-how, they have the knowledge and tools at their disposal to assist communities who would otherwise not have access to justice. So I would say that maybe it should come from during the studies that they educated on the need to provide community service, which would now filter into when they are professionals in having that moral sense to say, I could give this particular number of hours in a year in assisting indigent communities.
Sian or Max, I know you'd like to say something.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that given the costs of legal advice and given that lawyers have a specialized skill which they can offer to society, they should absolutely give some of those services to the poor for free.
And just on that note as well, I mean, the only way to even progressively realize this right in terms of Section 34, right of access to the courts, the only way to really realize that right is to join forces. I mean, you as an individual legal practitioner definitely have a moral obligation to provide your services so that people that don't understand the processes and don't understand how the court system works do actually have fully realizable right to access those courts.
Uzair, in our last few seconds of the show, do you think the state is actually living up to its obligation with regards to Section 34, the access to courts, and Section 38, enforcement of rights?
Dakira, to be honest, I do believe that the state is living up to its obligation. To many out there, it might not seem as if the state is, but again, we are 23 years young in our democracy, and we need to think about the fact that a lot of progress has been made.
Awesome. That's a wrap of a really interesting discussion. The time has come to an end. Thank you to my guests, Uzair Adams, Ellen Bariwando, Max Taylor, and Sian Fagan. And a big thank you to our technician, Abida Dixon. Tune in to VOC 91.3 FM next week at 6 p.m. for the 7th episode of Constitutional Matters. Just a reminder to our listeners that the views expressed in this show is not necessarily the views of the Voice of the Cape, its management, or its staff. You are listening to Constitutional Matters with myself, Zakira Desai. Assalamu alaikum. And good evening.